From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, some perspective on a June full of flash flooding and mudslides in Wisconsin.
Every town has to understand its flood risk, for example, and that requires detailed local information, and it's expensive to get that information.
We'll go out with some Milwaukeeans trying to eke out a living collecting and selling scrap metal. Dining critic Ann Christensen talks about the unique appeal to dining al fresco.
I mean, all of us have been there where you're at a restaurant and suddenly you're accosted by bees. I mean, or you've got some pizza on your table and there's flies all over it.
And Alex Grecian talks about his intriguing mystery novel, The Black Country. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. It was another wet night for much of southern Wisconsin, and more rain is in the forecast today. Flood warnings are out along many rivers and streams, including in Kenosha and Racine County. Flash flood warnings are also in effect around Madison and just to the south and west of Kenosha, while flash flood watches are posted for much of the southern half of the state, though not Milwaukee or Waukesha County at this point. The rainfall numbers have been impressive to date. In Milwaukee, we've now had more than 24.5 inches of precipitation this year, and Madison reports even more. And the frequency of flash flood warnings in Wisconsin has been a significant story in recent weeks. Kenneth Potter is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison and an expert on flooding and stormwater management. He joins us this morning by phone. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
The latest data I've read is that to date, this is the fourth wettest year on record for Milwaukee and the second wettest year for Madison. And the data is similar for other parts of the state, especially in the south. Do precipitation totals tell the whole story in your eye?
No, I don't think they do. Precipitation is a complicated thing that we don't completely understand in terms of its variability. So, for example, we can have long periods of time where it's dry. We can have long periods of time when it's wet. There's nobody around that remembers the fact that in the late 1800s, we had an extremely wet period. We have rainfall data actually from Madison, which shows that the high rainfall then was comparable to the high rainfall we've been experiencing in the last decade or so. The Mississippi River was high. The Great Lakes were high. There was particularly a high rainfall in Iowa where they had abundant data. So rainfall is a tricky thing to understand, largely because what controls the variation of rainfall over long periods of time is not fully understood.
I wonder, is part of the issue that that this year these high precipitation totals have come through frequent heavy storms, or is it even more than that?
Well, I think there were heavy storms back in the late 1800s, too. So clearly we're in a wet period. Clearly flooding is a big problem. It's also important to realize that we have a lot more observations, more quantitative observations today than we had, say, 50 years ago. And we also have people in more vulnerable situations. So, for example, we've urbanized further. So it's certainly a period of time where there's a lot of flooding, and it's something I think we have to take seriously because I think we understand better our vulnerability to flooding. But we don't really, it's hard to say how much of this is going to persist and whether it's going to get worse or not. I don't think we fully understand that.
Well, and in fact, many climate scientists have pointed to climate change as being a factor impacting the frequency and severity of storms, especially, you know, we've heard about hurricanes and tornadoes. Would you believe there are similar factors at work with a period like this in Wisconsin, though as everyone says, you know, you can't necessarily point to climate change as impacting a particular storm itself?
Yeah, I agree with the general scientific view. There's both theoretical evidence as well as data that show that and models, numerical models that show that changes in global climate because of increasing greenhouse gases will increase the number and intensity of storms. So there's certainly reason to believe that we're going to see bigger storms and more of them. But the models don't do a great job on precipitation, and so I don't think we know exactly how much bigger they're going to get or exactly how many more storms we're going to get per year.
But you would contend that years like this are likely to become more frequent?
That seems to be indicated by everything we know about the science.
You alluded to this a bit a couple minutes ago. There are flood warnings along many rivers and streams right now, but there are flash flood warnings in many, many other locations. Why has flash flooding become such a consistent part of the landscape, if you will?
Well, I think flash flooding always existed, and flash flooding really occurs at small scales where the area contributing to the flooding is small, and therefore the floods come up quickly. So I think we've always had flash flooding. I think we notice it more when we have more people out on the roads. We obviously notice it in urban areas. But I don't know that flash flooding has been a problem my whole career. I've been interested in floods for the last 40 years, and from the very beginning there was a significant increase in flash flooding. So I don't know that that's really changed. I think, again, we're just in a period of time where we're seeing more flash floods than we'd seen in previous years.
You mentioned urbanization, though, earlier. What has urbanization's impact on the flooding landscape, again, been in recent decades?
Well, urbanization is really of primary importance. The increase in flooding that results when one converts soil to impervious surfaces, such as concrete or asphalt or rooftops, causes great increases in the magnitude of floods, and particularly in flash flooding, because a lot of time the drainage areas are small. And so there's really nothing we can do worse than urbanize in terms of increasing floods. So the key is how we manage that increase in runoff. We have to remember that historically when people built, the idea was to get water away from whatever they built, and we learned after World War II that when you move water downstream, you just create problems for people downstream. So we've become way more sophisticated in how we deal with water in urban areas, but we really have a long way to go.
Well, and as an engineer, what are the steps that you believe could be and indeed ought to be taken in Wisconsin to lessen the risk of flash floods, especially given you say that this sort of period is likely to be a more common occurrence?
Well, one thing we do lead the nation in is green infrastructure. So we are doing a good job on stormwater practices that promote infiltration through rain gardens or that promote loss of water through evaporation through roof gardens. But what we haven't done a good job with is dealing with large events, and in particular in storing and detaining large events through detention ponds. There are no state rules in Wisconsin regarding control for large events. All the rules that control large events, and in particular the construction of large storages, large detention ponds, all those rules are local. They're either enacted by municipalities or by counties or towns or villages, and there really needs to be a statewide ordinance. What also concerns me is that there are very few municipalities or counties in the state that require control up to the 100-year flood. Most that do have ordinances to control large events stop at the 10-year event, and yet we know that the 100-year flood is what causes the serious damage. So I think that's a big gap in our regulatory structure in Wisconsin, and something that we need to address, both in terms of urbanization, but also remembering that the climate is changing and we are going to see bigger events and more of them.
Last summer, much of the state, as you mentioned, dealt with a prolonged drought. I'm curious, does the persistence of this wet period in Wisconsin have any long-term positive effects on either groundwater or even surface water?
Well, certainly the groundwater levels are going to recover after the drought if they haven't already recovered. And that's a good thing because we do have water shortages, believe it or not, in parts of the state because of excessive pumping. And so it's good that we're recharging groundwater, though I must say that these heavy rains don't recharge nearly as well as snowmelt or precipitation during the fall and winter and spring when you don't have evaporation. But still, we are recharging groundwater. The other thing to keep in mind is that floods are part of the natural environment, so So streams and rivers have always experienced floods, with or without humans, and ecosystems have adapted to those floods. So floods reconstitute streams. They move material in the bed. So there are a lot of good things that happen in floods. We wouldn't want to eliminate floods. And in fact, where we've built reservoirs and eliminated floods, we've created ecological problems. And a good example is the Colorado River, where we've basically eliminated all large floods because we've constructed large reservoirs, and therefore we've lost the natural ecosystems and a lot of the native species there. So, yeah, there are positive things associated with floods.
As someone who has studied floods and groundwater for much of his career, what are the kinds of questions that are key in your mind and your colleagues' mind as it pertains to these kinds of fields today?
Well, I think the real challenge, we understand conceptually how floods work in terms of the hydrological processes. We know about water running off, water infiltrating, water recharging groundwater. But we don't necessarily know how to quantify it in specific locations. So, for example, take the Central Sands in Wisconsin, where we're pumping to support a great agricultural system. But at the same time, we're lowering water tables. And there, the real question is, how much increase in evapotranspiration are we having because of pumping? So just coming up with site-specific numbers is important in making decisions because decisions are local. So understanding the concepts, understanding the science is important, but quantifying in specific places is important. And every city, every town has to understand its flood risk, for example. And that requires detailed local information, and it's expensive to get that information. So I think that's the big challenge. Big challenge is to understand our vulnerability, to quantify, put numbers on it so that we can manage better.
Well, Ken Potter, thank you so much for shedding some light on this for us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
Ken Potter is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He specializes in flooding and stormwater management. He joined us on the line from Madison. You can find the latest on the flooding situation in parts of Wisconsin from links at WUWM.com. A short break now, and in just a moment, a report on the growing practice of scrapping among some in Milwaukee, collecting and reselling scrap metal to help make enough money to get by. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee's economy is improving slowly, but it's still one of the poorest cities in the country. With unemployment high, some people are surviving by collecting and selling recyclable metal. Lake Effect's Amy Kiley explores what it takes to be a scrapper.
A couple years ago, Transformation City Church in Milwaukee experienced a strange phenomenon. During renovations, metal garbage vanished. Community pastor Tim Nelson decided to play detective.
So I sat out there one day eating lunch, and I noticed that there was folks that pulled up in an old beat-up pickup truck, and they'd ask, hey, can we take this metal? Yeah. And realized that they were scrapping the metal.
He saw that scrappers tended to be African-American men.
And I got to talk to folks and even develop some relationships with some folks and realized that most of them were doing this as their primary source of income.
For Milwaukee's black men, getting a job is hard. Of those aged 16 to 64, only about 45% are employed. This region is arguably the nation's most segregated, and public transportation to suburban jobs is spotty. Nobody gets rich junk collecting, but scrapyards pay for metal they can sell to refineries. For people with few options, that means income. For Nelson, it meant extra money for church renovations, so he tried scrapping himself. Nelson takes off from the church parking lot. He drives down nearby alleys to show how it's done.
Yeah, it's a TV right there, but it's already been busted open and had the guts removed. So here, you'll see. Yeah, so that's an example of we were a little bit too late here.
It turns out it's too late for the whole neighborhood. After all, this is a low-income area. Scrappers live here, so the alleys are picked dry. Nelson moves to the suburbs next, where the regulations are looser. The city of Milwaukee requires professional scrappers to have a permit, but even the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in favor of junk collectors. Pastor Nelson drives through the North Shore. He pulls the bed of his truck up to a construction dumpster, hops in, and strikes scrapper gold. He lifts up a chunk of metal the size of a bowling ball.
Yes, it's like a big old, looks like a motor for an old fan. I mean, you can hear it.
At the scrapyard, the motor weighs in at 39 pounds. Nelson says the copper wires inside make it worth more.
You know, I keep asking for the price for motors so that I get a better price than if I just ask for metal. You got to be smart. It's not just about looking for metal. It's like figuring out how to have it all packaged right so that you get the most for the metal you have.
Lamar Cox is also at the scrapyard selling an old car strut. He has four daughters and does contract work and car repairs.
I figure the ones that throw it away, you know, I guess they got it like that. They don't need the money, but I don't got it like that. So whatever, every little bit helps me.
Of course, not all scrapping is legal. Foreclosed homes attract copper thieves. A former scrapyard worker is unloading old fencing from a garage renovation. He says it's hard to spot stolen metal, except when it's labeled property of the city of Milwaukee. In Milwaukee County, most African-American men spend time in prison before turning 50. A felony can keep someone from getting a junk collector's permit, but Jeffrey Benn points out anyone can scrap.
You know, a lot of people do have bad records. Nowadays, you know what I'm saying, they're looking for some kind of degree. But we just got to hang on in there and just do what we have to do.
Ben does maintenance work for a local school. He says he sells metal his employers discard. Meanwhile, Pastor Nelson stands in line outside a sales window covered by security bars. Presenting ID and signing to declare his sale is legal, he gets paid.
We come out with 2.5-3 hours of work and coming out with $21 minus gas. That's like $16.19 for 2.5 hours of work.
Nelson won't quit his day job. Those without other options will probably keep scrapping. For Lake Effect, I'm Amy Kiley.
There's more from the scrapping journey of Lake Effect's Amy Kiley at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another break now, and in just a moment, our dining contributor traces the Milwaukee Chef Matrix and talks about the decidedly summer tradition of dining outside. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. When it comes to the trendy dining scene in Milwaukee, the city's chef pedigree is growing. Restaurants are attracting diners today, not just with tasty menu offerings, but also with the promise of well-known chefs in the kitchen. Unlike the national scene, in which chefs are celebrities thanks to their TV show-honed personalities, Milwaukee's celebrity chefs get that way based on their culinary reputation alone. But our dining contributor, Ann Christensen, also points out that Milwaukee's big-name chefs are often very mobile, maybe even dynamic, which is why she created a chef matrix in the latest issue of Milwaukee Magazine, a fun look at where chefs have been and where they're going. She tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about who she included on her matrix.
What I would have loved to have done was to have head chefs, sous chefs, and pastry chefs on this list, but I realized that it would become such a huge challenge and it would become a giant twister board or something. It would be huge. So I had to limit it. And so I limited it to 15 head chefs because I knew there would be so much interaction there and that it would be like a hornet's nest almost of all this interweaving. How are we going to make this work? And plus I had to talk to a graphic designer on staff who'd be able to create this thing. But it's something I had been thinking about for a long time. And at one point, the way I thought of doing this was it would be like a solar system. And the chefs would be different planets. And maybe the restaurants would be like, I don't know, satellites or shooting stars or
moons.
Something on the moon. I don't know. Anyway, but it became, as you've said, a matrix. And it charts these 15 chefs actively working right now in Milwaukee. It begins where the first restaurant they worked at, And then it kind of charts their progress over the years to where they're working now. Now, however, I didn't include country clubs because I thought that, you know, generally speaking, you know, you have to be a member to go to them. And plus, that would add many more places and make this list even more complicated, or the matrix more complicated. But if you look at this thing, it's like a really crazy, like, EKG. I mean, that's kind of how it looks. It's pretty crazy. Then you add the component of restaurants that have closed. So in the key, we explained, we flagged, okay, which restaurants are no longer operating, which ones have changed their names and become something else, but it's still the same owner. Situations where a chef left a restaurant, went somewhere else, went back to that restaurant, or opened that restaurant, closed that restaurant, reopened it again, or reopened it, rather. So it's I think it's a really fun section in the magazine, in the June issue, but it's a challenge. It's a challenge to do it. But I think it's one of the coolest things that we've done or tried to do. I think, like I said, I wanted to do it in a huge form and have a lot more people. But I think that would have had to have been a pullout chart.
Well, that would be cool.
I know.
Do a pullout. Yeah.
I think it could be done again.
Or maybe maybe like a model, scale model that you can build.
Right. Right.
Well, okay, I'll blame you for this because your analogy about the chefs being planets and, you know, the whole solar system around it. So when did chefs here become stars, if you will? I mean, people that read this will know a good at least five of these chefs, just by name anyway.
Well, let's see. Who turns the chefs into stars? Well, I guess the media to a certain extent. But that's reflected by the attention that national, international chefs have gotten through the Food Network, all of the TV shows, you know, the books, people like Anthony Bourdain. Those people are really, you know, Rachel Ray. All of those people are celebrities, Guy Fieri, you know, because the national media and because the Food Network has made them so.
But here there are stars,
yes,
without even having programs.
It's true.
Just by reputation, it seems like.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's the case. These are chefs that are consistently doing excellent things. And so then, you know, they consistently appear in stories, you know, or reviews about restaurants or a matrix, you know, for instance, that we do. But yeah, I think people, there's also this sense that, you know, and again, maybe it goes back to Anthony Bourdain, that people sort of compared him to, and I think it was he himself who said he's sort of like the chef, you know, Keith Richards or something like that. They see chefs as a little bit more interesting or badass, or, I mean, just kind of, it's a little more creative and interesting profession, perhaps, than someone would say, like, you know, a CPA. I don't know. But there could be, you know, celebrity CPAs, I guess, too, right? But maybe there's something sexy about chefs. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about another topic in the June issue, which is that of outside dining etiquette or patio etiquette.
Yes.
Not something we give a lot of thought to, but just before we went on the air, we rattled off at least five topics for discussion as far as dining outside.
Correct, because I don't think until you start to really, you know, or someone starts to list all the things that go into dining outside that makes it different from dining inside, then you realize, this perhaps presents a few challenges that do not happen when you're dining inside. So this is not the topmost one, but, you know, think about when you go to a restaurant, inside a restaurant, right? And let's say you've got like six people and you walk into the dining room and you've got maybe, I don't know, two tops or something. Are you going to take it upon yourself to just walk up to those tables and push them all together and make your own table to accommodate six people? Probably not, right? You're going to say something to the hostess, the server, and say, you know, is there any way that we can, you know, push these tables together so that we can all sit together? Apparently, at some restaurants, when you're outside and it's like patio tables, people like to move the tables just because they think they can. I don't know.
And are you saying it's not okay?
What I'm saying is I'm hearing that it can become an issue. I think that at some restaurants, they don't like you to do that. Kind of like they wouldn't want you to do it inside unless you ask somebody first. Because maybe they want to have those tables set aside for parties of two or parties of four. They don't want you to put these tables together and create your own party. I don't know.
Well, I might be wrong, but is it generally assumed or is it a safe assumption that dining outside is more lax or relaxed, that the same rules don't apply outside?
I don't think so. I think many of the same rules do apply inside. You know, for instance, just as there's a non-smoking policy inside restaurants, there are a lot of restaurants that won't let you smoke on their patio. But some will let you smoke if it's not within a certain number of feet of the entrance so that people inside are not getting the cigarette smoke. Obviously, you cannot bring a pet inside, a pet, and I'm speaking specifically of dogs, inside a restaurant. You know, that you just can't do that. This is in Paris, you know. But some restaurants will say, yeah, it's fine to bring your dog to the patio. But, and I checked with the health department because they say that it's up to the restaurant operator and then they can allow it. If it's outdoors, obviously you can't let the animals inside. But I think it probably requires some policing too because, you know, I've been sitting outside and seen people have a dog in their lap. And yet have you been to a restaurant where you've seen a dog kind of see another dog and then they start barking or snapping at each other?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, that can happen too. So I would think that's not an ideal situation when you have a lot of diners outside.
Okay. Well, is there a difference between, like, a lot of places have tables set up out front?
Yes.
Where the dogs don't have to walk through the restaurant, but a lot of places have patios that are only accessible through the restaurant. So
in those situations, I don't think they can have dogs on the patio because the dog has to be taken through the restaurant. I think it's limited to restaurants where you have an outside access point to the patio or it's sidewalk seating. You know, for instance, I've heard from the Lowlands group that at Benelux, you can have dogs outside on the sidewalk where you can seated outside, but you can't go up on the roof with your dog because that would mean obviously walking through the restaurant to get upstairs. So I think that is prohibited if you have to bring your animal inside.
What about weather-related concerns? I mean, we of course talked before we went on the air about people who want to sit outside when it's raining or lightly raining or whatever, cloudy, and really consider, you know, all the factors in that.
It's tricky because some restaurants, I think, and maybe be able to, let's say it starts raining, they might be able to move diners inside to tables. But perhaps they're too busy, though, and they can't, you know, accommodate the diners inside. I mean, that would hopefully be in rare circumstances where the only place they can sit is outside. However, if it's raining a little bit, I would think that a lot of restaurants have their own policies. Hey, if it's starting to storm, we're just evacuating the patio. But if it's showering a little bit, that means your server's getting wet. You may not be because you might be covered. You know, you might have an umbrella over you. But perhaps you should think about the fact that, you know, your server's getting wet, your food's getting wet. Maybe it's time to move it inside. But wind is another factor.
Yeah. And I remember us talking about this before, but just the idea of insects and all these things that come with being outside. Some people, for some reason, seem to think that a restaurant can make it insect-free outside.
Yes. And I mean, all of us have been there where you're at a restaurant and suddenly you're accosted by bees. I mean, or you've got some pizza on your table and there's flies all over it. I mean, those are not good situations, believe me. I don't like to be in them. But I do know that there are restaurants that really try to do things to, you know, cut down on mosquitoes and things like that. To an extent, it's impossible to prevent a stray ant from crawling up your leg just because you're outside. At the same time, you know, if I see a butterfly nearby, I mean, I think, well, isn't that charming? Because that's the bonus of sitting outside, right? Because you have the sounds, the smells, the air, the wind. I mean, a little bit of all those things that you don't get when you're stuck in this sterile environment inside.
Okay, here's something I bet you haven't thought of.
Okay.
What is etiquette, like if you're sitting outside on a sidewalk restaurant, what is the expectation of interaction between you and pedestrians? Or is it, because I think people are much more willing to talk to people when they're sitting outside on a sidewalk and get involved in the street scene, you know, wherever it is. Do you think that's...
Are you speaking from experience, Dan?
Maybe. But do you think that it's kind of... weird to all of a sudden someone's having a conversation with people walking by and it turns into this, gab session.
Like they might stop and say, hey, what are you eating? What is that? Hey,
yeah.
I like your pants or something like that. I think that's strange, and I don't think that you're a sideshow if that's kind of what you – that's almost what you're suggesting to me is that because you're seated out there, you're fair game for whatever pedestrian is going by and feels like they can – heckle you or
right.
talk to you or even just try to engage you in conversation seems to me not to be I don't believe that you are expected to become part of the part of whatever scene they're trying to create.
All right. Or you can get panhandled.
Exactly. That's all another right. situation. Yeah, that is the that's the worst case scenario probably right there.
What about just kind of different expectations of comfort outside? Some places have really great patio furniture, outdoor furniture, and they have heat lamps.
Blankets. Sometimes they'll bring you a snuggie.
I've
heard of that.
Not experienced that one, but do you think there's any foods that are just not conducive to being served outside?
I personally think that a lot of foods are because I have this thing about food that's just not at the right temperature. You know, it's not served at the right temperature and it's going to cool off pretty fast by the time you get outside. But that being said, though, I mean, what's better than having a cookout, like a steak on the grill or a burger on the grill? And maybe, like, contradicting myself here and saying there's maybe not much except for, like, you know, a giant hot fudge sundae on a 90-degree day. Unless you're willing to eat it, I mean, just like going to Cops, you just eat it right away so it just doesn't melt. Maybe things that are really cold, that are supposed to be really cold, you just want to eat it right away. I kind of think of festival food, you know what I mean? You just are expected to eat anything fried. You want to eat it right away. It's just not, the shelf life's not going to be that long.
The only maybe problem, I'm using air quotes here, that I've had is with food that contains things that will be blown away easily. And that it could even be breadcrumbs on a salad or just light pieces of lettuce that can just easily be blown off the table or off of your plate.
Wow, that would be a windy predicament,
yeah,
I would think.
It happens, yeah.
I've never had a salad where ingredients in the salad blew away.
Hmm. It does happen.
I think of more when it's windy enough, your napkins are flying.
Yeah, that's
or
true.
A certain thing, and you have to like bolt them down with a cup or something. It seems like it's more, you know, kind of parts of the place settings that end up going away.
The other thing I've noticed, some places use plastic outside because it's just safer, but as soon as it gets empty or empty-ish, it's more likely to blow away.
If you're dining at a nicer restaurant and you're getting like plastic outside as opposed to the silverware that they use inside, that seems less than ideal for me.
Just walk away.
Yeah, just walk away.
All right. Well, maybe we can have a recap at the end of September and see how things have gone this
after
summer.
After a summer of dining outside.
After our 2 weeks of summer, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Ann.
Thank you, Dan.
Ann Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine and Lake Effect's regular dining contributor. She talked with Dan Harmon about dining outdoors and about the Milwaukee Chef Matrix she compiled in the current issue of the magazine. One last break, and then we'll meet the author of a dark mystery set in England's coal country in the late 19th century. Alex Grecian joins us when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The English countryside might seem like an alluring, bucolic place for a getaway, and that is probably true in modern times, but in the England of the late 19th century, small, rural English villages were hardscrabble places full of superstition and often illness. And that is the England of Alex Grecian's new novel, The Black Country. It's Grecian's dark second mystery featuring Scotland Yard's murder squad and detectives Walter Day and Neville Hammersmith. Grecian was in Milwaukee recently to talk about his latest effort, and he joined us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What is it about your setting that attracts you? Why and why write period mysteries rather than plots that play out in contemporary settings?
Nobody was very interested in reading my contemporary books, so I went with historical. And I think the Victorian era especially is familiar to us, but it's still kind of alien too, because obviously they're doing the same things that we do. But in a lot of cases, they're doing those things in much different ways than we do, and that's interesting, and we can learn a little bit.
Do you have to go through kind of an exercise in taking like modern day – do you run things through almost a translation filter? You know, this is how this mystery might play out today. Now how can I make it play out in Victorian England?
That's interesting. I kind of do, but I do so much research before I start writing the book that I'm pretty well steeped in that. So I write it as if I were writing it then. But the first book I actually wrote, The Yard, in a modern slang kind of way, and I thought I would – I was just experimenting with it, with modern language in Victorian England. And then when I was done, it sounded too gimmicky, so I just cleaned it all up and got rid of the modern stuff.
Well, but at the same time, what strikes me in reading this is even though it is set somewhere else in an earlier time, it doesn't necessarily – it doesn't feel dated, first of all, and it doesn't feel – difficult to read. It doesn't necessarily play itself out in a Victorian way.
I'm very much writing modern thrillers set in Victorian England. So that's my whole goal, really.
Do you feel in doing that, is there greater freedom for you, or is it confining to have to hew to the historically authentic line?
It's kind of interesting. It's a little of both. If I were writing contemporary mysteries, I would always have to figure out how the hero could lose his cell phone or, you know, why it would take him a day to get to the city next to his. Here, there are enough constraints that the mystery can actually be more mysterious and take longer to solve and fill up a whole novel.
You live in Kansas, correct?
I do, yes.
Is there a trick to you in being able to sit in your writing studio or your office or your coffee shop or wherever it is that you write in Kansas and be able to so convincingly channel the British Midlands? I mean, are you there when you're writing there?
I actually write in a period phone booth. That's it. No, I don't. No, it is interesting. I do have a gigantic map of Victorian London right behind my chair that fills the entire office wall. So, and I have dry erase markers so I can mark out where I am at any moment and where my characters need to be. So it really kind of does feel like I'm there except for the Mac I'm writing on.
Well, and another thing that struck me is that it's very easy, you know, as we're following the action in one part of the story, it's easy to imagine that the rest of this town is existing even though we're not watching it or reading it as it plays out. You know, I think it's easy to imagine parallel stuff going on even as we read what you're writing about.
Yeah, it's I'm writing about normal people who just happen to be stuck in the past. So I, with the dialogue especially, I try to write it pretty much the way modern people talk, just not quite so obvious.
And do I understand correctly you have not yet been to England?
Oi. No, I haven't. And at this point, it's a little more embarrassing than it is a talking point. But I'm going in July. I'm spending the entire month of July researching the next book in London. So the next book will be much more authentic.
Well, I wonder, are you afraid of going there and finding out that, oh my God, I've gotten this all wrong all this time?
Very much. I'm afraid they'll throw things at me, actually.
People don't really say govna. How long have Neville Hammersmith and Walter Day been with you?
Really, they're both – well, Day is me pretty much and Kingsley is me pretty much, the other half of me. Hammersmith though is sort of Bruce Willis in, but in Victorian England. So he's very much a modern American action hero who gets his shirt ripped off and gets bloodied up in every book, and that's funny for me.
Chicks dig him.
My wife has a huge crush on him. For the second book, she was telling me what I could and couldn't do with him and – you know, I can't kill him, apparently.
Although, the mystery novels are tough because we don't want to give anything away.
But ooh, spoiler.
You come close in a couple of places.
He's got a rough road there, yeah.
And again, I don't think this is ruining anything. As this book goes on, Walter Day is He I mean, this book takes place in Blackhampton as opposed to London, where the Yard takes place. But London is very much on the mind of Walter Day, who is expecting his first child. Was that a situation? Were you yourself going through that?
Oh, not this time around. Okay. But in the first book, The Yard, there's a little boy who's kidnapped. And I use children a lot in both books because they scare me, because I do have a son and he's right about the same age as the kidnapped boy in the first book. And so I tried to build suspense by throwing in the things that frighten me. So hopefully they frighten other people.
As we say, this takes place in Blackhampton, which, as you have portrayed it, is not what you would call a quaint, picturesque sort of place. What makes this place tick?
Well, it's I made up Blackhampton, but it's sort of an amalgamation of real black country places. And I tried to pinpoint, you know, what set that apart from London, because I wanted this to have a creepier vibe. So I may have gone overboard in just picking the creepy things in the black country, but they are all authentic. The children's rhymes are authentic in it. The superstitions are authentic. And the most implausible thing in the whole book is the houses and businesses sinking into the mines. And that sounds like something I made up, but I didn't. That's really what was happening.
It also has a beautiful metaphorical quality to it as
Thank
well.
You. Yes, yes. That was why I chose that. But reading the diaries of housewives who lived in the actual black country back then, they were always having to take off and go help a neighbor dig out his or her front door because that house had fallen 2 feet into the tunnels.
And there are several points in this book that people are literally shaken up by being inside a structure that is settling into the mines.
Right, right. And really, this book is about secrets and the responsibilities, and the secrets that these people have been harboring are undermining them. So it is very symbolic.
What lies beneath? Well, and there's also this undercurrent of social justice in this. Things like, you know, child labor in the mines, and also the thing that is sickening people, you know, the sort of lack of fresh water quality.
Yeah, it's almost a plague there. And really, it's all about the clash of science versus superstition, because in that time period, people were fascinated by science and science was becoming more and more important, but they still clung to their old superstitions. And so I think it was probably a very rocky time to try to get used to the world.
Well, and I would imagine this is kind of the real rub in terms of the town appreciates the help of Neville, you know, of Hammersmith and Day, but they also don't. There's a realization that London represents something else.
Right. No good deed goes unpunished.
You have also worked in graphic fiction in the past, correct?
Yes. Yes.
How is it for you to go from that form where there is a literal image to support the story to one in which the image has to exist in your head and in the reader's head?
Honestly, it's so much easier. There's a weird rhythm when you're writing comic books or graphic novels. You have to stop and start constantly because you have to describe for the artist what to draw in every single panel and then, you know, write down the dialogue and then move on. You have to stop the dialogue then and move on and write the next panel's description so that the artist can get it all down the way you see it in your head. So with a novel, though, I can throw two people in a room and have them talk for pages and pages and pages, and I'm fine. I don't have to stop. I don't have to describe anything for the artist, and I also don't have to change anything because the artist drew something I didn't intend, which can be really interesting, but it's more freeing for me to write a novel.
Is it ever difficult for you to exist in this dark world where bad stuff not only happens but is supposed to happen? I mean, for there to be a mystery, something bad has to play out, and also to have the positive outlook that is necessarily a part of being a parent?
Wow. Well, a happy character isn't a very interesting character. So that's one of the hardships of writing. You create these people that you care about, and then you have to put them through the ringer in order to make them interesting for other people. So it's a little tough, but I suppose I probably don't believe in happy endings anyway. I try to give them some kind of closure at the end of each book so that the people who live through the book are at least not completely dour and down. But yeah, it's not a pretty thing. I write about murder, so
the dedication to the book I thought was wonderful.
Yeah, my son is 9 right now, so he can't read this for quite a while. Yeah. He already has nightmares.
Do you feel like, I mean, you have these two characters that inhabit the yard and they inhabit the black country, and I would imagine, are they going to inhabit the next book?
They are. I'm writing that right now. Hopefully I'm finished by the time I get back from London. But yeah, people seem to have responded to these two characters. When I started this, it was going to be a revolving set of characters, and each book would focus on a different detective, a different constable, whoever. And I introduced a whole murder squad in the first book. But then when it came time to write the second one, I didn't really want to move on from Day and Hammersmith, so they made it into the second book and the third.
Do you in your mind, feel like you have to make each individual book distinct?
Yeah, I don't really have to fight against it so much because I don't know what I'm doing. So I sort of start over with each book and I don't outline. So I hit the ground running and hope that by the end of the book I have something worth reading.
Well, this one was definitely worth reading. Alex Grecian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alex Grecian's latest novel is called The Black Country. It's the follow-up to his first murder mystery called The Yard. We spoke with him while he was in town recently for events at Mystery One Bookstore and Boswell Book Company. There's a link to an excerpt from The Black Country from WUWM.com. Lake Effect essayist Corinthia Klein also has a new novel out. And she struggled with the idea of having troubling things happening in the world that she created.
As far back as I can remember, I always thought it would be exciting to write a book. I toyed with the idea on and off for years. It probably would have made more sense to attempt to write fiction for the first time before becoming immersed in child rearing, but the impulse to finally write did not strike me until I was well down that road. Is there a mother who loves her children who doesn't live with the fear of losing them? Especially in the early years, the idea of something unspeakable happening to any of my babies often made it hard for me to sleep. It was too terrible to contemplate, but somehow impossible not to. I wondered about the toll such a loss would take on me, if I would be strong enough to bear it. But becoming preoccupied with such thoughts felt wrong. I needed a distraction. I'm a person who likes to pursue creative outlets. But many of the ones I'd enjoyed before having children were difficult to do in tandem with my new role as a mother. So I came back to the idea of a novel. I liked the thought of a project that I could carry around in my head and contemplate on my own unpredictable schedule, even as my hands were full with the endless chores of caring for my children. If it took the rest of my life, it didn't matter. I could stop and start it when I chose. I started out cautiously. I began with a name. From there, I created a woman I felt I knew. I made her a marriage I could relate to. I chose her friends and her interests, decorated her home, and created her past. The whole exercise was far more fun than I expected it to be, and instead of it becoming a background project that I could pick up and put down over the course of years, I ended up cranking out most of the original draft in a matter of weeks. I loved writing that first novel. There's an interesting thing about creative fields, however, that I don't know to be true in any of the other work I've done. Many concepts that would be considered unhealthy to dwell upon in day-to-day life are deemed perfectly natural to focus on in order to make art. It's expected that artistic people will think about death and suffering, along with joy and beauty. This is why the arts are necessary in our lives, because they give us an opportunity to grapple with difficult ideas at whatever distance we need in order to help understand them. If you are creating art, you can tackle such ideas intimately, and instead of this being considered disturbing, it's embraced and deemed commendable. An actor must imagine pain to effectively simulate it. Musicians, composers, dancers, visual artists, all must delve into the heart of emotional significance of their work for it to have any meaning or authenticity. Writers who can't get into the heads of their characters to understand their emotional lives can't create convincing stories. When I obsessed over the idea of what would happen if I lost one of my own children, that felt ghoulish and ungrateful. But if I were writing about losing a child as part of a novel, To allow myself to wallow in those thoughts and that imagined pain was now necessary and productive. It turned a questionable train of thought into an acceptable action. By simply declaring my dark thoughts to be research, they were permissible to have. So within my story of nice people doing the best they can while coping with mundane struggles, I created a child. She was charming and pretty and adored. I gave her a personality and quirky interests and particular habits and a favorite toy. I loved her. And then I killed her. I watched as my fingers tapped away at my laptop, stringing together words that unraveled the world I had made. I watched everyone suffer and grieve and try to deal with such an unspeakable loss. I saw them weep and wonder how such a thing could happen. And I suffered with them and tried to work through it and move past it and attempt to let it go so that I could get whatever this was out of my system and simply enjoy my own kids who were safe and fine and alive. It was writing as self-help in a way, and for the most part it did the trick. But I wasn't expecting the guilt. I now live with the fact that I created a child and that I let her die. I know she is fictional, and I am not pretending for a moment that an invented person in a book compares to someone real. But I still felt responsibility for her. To be able to write her convincingly, she had to feel real to me. In my story, her cause of death is an accident, but I chose the accident. As I watched my characters look for answers, I realized those answers all lay with their author, and I didn't have any good ones. They wanted to know why, and I realized how little any of my reasons would mean to them. I didn't have an answer for why that they would accept. I had created their lives and could have made them anything I wished, and I wished them tragedy for the sake of my story. When people struggle with finding meaning in the universe, many end up questioning how a loving creator could allow suffering. If you had power over all creation, why would you allow harm to come to anyone undeserving, particularly a child? What sense is there in that? If a God can do anything and chooses horror, either by direct action or deliberate inaction, is that a creator with any decency? Is that creator still, in essence, a good person? And now part of me is left to wonder, am I?
Essayist Corinthia Klein is a violin maker and the mother of three in Milwaukee. She and her husband, a veteran, run a neighborhood violin store called Corinthian Violins in Bayview. She also performs on the viola with the Festival City Symphony and on mandola with the Milwaukee Mandolin Orchestra. She blogs at Corinthia's Quiet Corner. Her new novel is called Almost There, and there's a link to more about it from wuwm.com/lake effect. Thanks for listening to Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Before we go, in the final days of WUWM's fiscal year, we're inviting you to make a contribution before Sunday at wuwm.com/give or by calling us at 414-270-1225. Thank you so much for helping us finish the fiscal year stronger than ever. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much as well for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.